Hi, everybody. I'm Tim Urban, guiding teacher here at Zen Center, and I'm really happy to introduce our guest speaker tonight, Mark Nunberg. And many of you have been to Common Ground Meditation Center, which Mark started in, I think, 1993. And it's been going by leaps and bounds since then. When I first visited it, it was pretty tiny, and there was just a small group of people. Now I understand they're inundated with folks. Bought some country land in western Wisconsin and slowly developing that. And they have Mark was just telling me they have a number of community groups, too, who meet outside Common Ground and focus on meditation. And Mark is in the Vipassana tradition, which comes out of Theravada Buddhism. And many of you know Spirit Rock and IMS, which also he's associated with. So, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Thank you, everyone. Do I need to start the recorder? It's already going. Okay. Well, it's nice to be here tonight. Nice to see everybody. When I walked in, I saw Rosemary here, and I think she was here the last time I spoke. And it turns out that the last time I was here, 10 years ago or whatever it was, I spoke on renunciation, and it turns out that's what I thought it would be nice to share about tonight. And it's an interesting topic, because when we hear about renunciation, you might just notice now a kind of contraction or fear. There's always this sense in Buddhism that all that is beloved. You know, we hear a lot about death, and we hear a lot about attachment. And so when we hear the teaching on renunciation, we fear that in a life that's already, for many of us, a lot of the times a bit of a struggle, we feel like, and now I'm going to be asked to give away my cell phone, my car that works, or my, you know, friend, my friendships, my ice cream in the freezer, my beautiful meditation center on the shores of Lake Calhoun. It's so tranquil walking here. We're on a relatively busy street and near the Mississippi River. So it's, but yet we know, if anybody who's looked at the teachings of the Buddha, we know the Buddha makes a big deal about renunciation. In fact, often when he talks about Nibbana or Nirvana, the sort of culmination of our practice, that realization of freedom, he talks about it in terms of letting go or going beyond of greed, anger, and delusion, or the heart being independent. So in the world, but independent, not dependent on what's in our freezer, our loved ones, our health, possessions, fame. So it's just provocative, you know, for a group of people to spend an evening contemplating the joy or happiness of non-attachment, or the joy or happiness of renunciation. And to really look at our lives as a junction, two roads. You know, the road of the pursuit of craving, thinking that attachment, craving, getting what we want. And we don't want to pathologize that. We just want to understand that so much of the conditioning in our mind and our heart is in the pursuit, even the pursuit of sitting still and looking like a good Zen student, right? That's also thinking it's that Joko Beck calls it the promise that's never kept. Some of you maybe have read her books, wonderful books. You know, the thought that when I can finally sit still, when I can finally, when this mind finally settles, then I'll be a happy human being. When I can actually survive the 7-day sesshin at Hokkyoji, then I'll be a happy then. You know, my relationships will work. So we can turn anything, you know, into this road of craving, thinking that there's something that's going to make me happy. And it's very enticing, because even the thought of like really getting into shape. I used to do a lot of physical exercise when I was younger, and then I used to do a lot of yoga. I gave up the physical, the kind of more hardcore physical exercise, and I got really into yoga for 5 or 7 years, and I gave that up, and I got into Qigong. Now I don't do that much of that. So I have kind of, oh yeah, well, I'm going to get back into shape, and then I'll be happy. So I'm not saying that that wouldn't be good for me to do something more physical in my life. But to the degree I make my mind dependent on it, that my happiness, my well-being is dependent on conditions, then right now I can see, just from paying attention with wisdom, that I'm tight, that the heart is tight, tied in knots, weighed down. And here's the real kicker. Having that projection in my mind, that idea that I'll be happy if I finally start some kind of healthy exercise regimen and do it religiously, and then I'll be happy, that right now that the fixedness in my mind being dependent on that idea, that image of getting into shape or being a good Zen student or whatever it might be. So even the good things, let alone the not-so-wholesome things we crave, that right now we can see it's suffering. The mind being dependent on it is a contraction right now. And so if we're a good student of the Buddha, we know that suffering doesn't lead to suffering, to the end of suffering, right? Suffering leads to more suffering. Wrong view, sort of personalizing the conditions, seeing ourselves in terms of the conditions in our lives, the conditions that come and go, and getting dependent on those conditions, creating a dependency on those conditions, that identification and that tension, that stress, that dukkha, is the cause for more dukkha. So what is this other path? There's a wonderful story from the suttas that I thought I'd share. Maybe some of you have heard it. I find it one of the more delightful discourses. So it involves Ananda, some of you know, was the attendant of the Buddha and cousin, a Buddhist monk. And he is known for having a lot of relationships with the lay people, the non-monks and nuns, and also the nuns, a real supporter of the nuns at the time of the Buddha. In any case, he was talking to some lay people and he brought them to see the Buddha. And they were talking about renunciation. And so those lay folks are there and Ananda's recounting what they had told him. And he says to the Buddha, in terms of what the householders had said, "We are householders who indulge in sensuality," right? Indulge in sense experiences. "Delight in sense experience, enjoy sense experience, rejoice in sense experience." So it sounds a lot like us, right? We enjoy them, sometimes we delight in our sense experiences. And he goes on, "For us, indulging in sensuality, delighting, enjoying, rejoicing in sensuality, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off," right? Like, I don't get it. And then they go on and they say, and yet, it's because they're confused. And yet, there seems to be young people, young women, young men, who ordain, become Buddhist monks and nuns, and their hearts seem to leap up at renunciation, grow confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as peace. So right here is where this doctrine, this training, is contrary to the great mass of people, right? To the mainstream culture. And so this is true for us too. It's like when we, it can even be frightening, you know, when we hear stories or imagine in our own mind, not maybe not being a monk or a nun, but just going on a sesshin, going on a Buddhist retreat, where we're leaving behind our homes, and we're leaving behind the control of our schedule, and we don't get to choose what we eat. We just show up at the dining hall, and or you're doing oryoki, and you just get what you get. And it can feel like, well, I'm not sure I want to do that. Because, like I said earlier, we tend to think that happiness comes, we equate happiness with being comfortable. And it's totally okay. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that we do that because, and the Buddha says this, if there wasn't a pleasantness in getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want, beings wouldn't be attached. So of course we get attached because there is some pleasantness in getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. But he doesn't end there. He says, and if there wasn't any suffering in the pursuit of our cravings, our attachments, beings wouldn't become disillusioned and disenchanted with craving. And if there was no escape, there wouldn't be beings who are free. So the householders talk to the Buddha, or Pu Ananda talk to the Buddha about how they just don't get it. Like, they see the purpose of their lives, you know, maybe they're good people, so their pursuit of pleasant sense experience means it also includes not harming others, or not harming others too much in the pursuit of their sense, pleasant sense experiences, and avoidance of unpleasant sense experiences. That's what they delight in, that's what they rejoice in, that's what they seek. And they just don't get how beings, other beings, might find joy in renunciation. So here's what the Buddha says. So it is, Ananda. Even I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, someone on the way to awakening, thought renunciation is good, seclusion is good, like a mind. Seclusion is not just being in the forest alone. It's really referring to a mind that's not confused. So the real deeper meaning of seclusion is a mind that's not confused by pleasant and unpleasant experience. So normally when pleasant and unpleasant experience comes, when our mind is not secluded, then we immediately, because of the conditioning of our mind, we immediately feel, I have to do something because it's really pleasant. So I need to do something to make it last longer, to hold on to it, to make it mine. Or if it's really unpleasant, then when my mind is not clear, when there's not a lot of wisdom, then I feel, I really need to do something. I feel threatened by the unpleasantness of my knee or an unpleasant emotion or memory. I have to do something to get rid of that. But when the mind's secluded in this deeper sense, it means the mind has withdrawn from wrong view, from thinking that the feeling, the pleasantness and unpleasantness of whatever is coming and going in our experience is something we have to react to. We have to be, as a practitioner, intimate with it, connecting, present, but we don't have to be confused, because we know, because of the wisdom and awareness, we know that there's this option of being aware that it's unpleasant now. It's like this. The heart feels heavy, and it's like this now. This pain in the heart, this ache in the knee, this confusion feels like this. It's just this experience being known. So we have this other option, which is to be radically present, knowing, intimate, knowing that it's like this, unpleasant, but not confused by the unpleasant. So knowing that it's really pleasant, really beautiful, really great. This is just what I've always wanted to do. But not confused by how beautiful, how pleasant it is. so that our action, our response in the moment isn't being driven by the pleasantness or unpleasantness. Our response arises out of compassion or metta, love, not some fear of losing what's beautiful and pleasant or being stuck with what's unpleasant. So again, the Buddha says, even I myself, before my awakening, my heart didn't leap up at renunciation. But see, because the Buddha, now he's talking about himself before his awakening, so he was a practitioner on his way to awakening. And being a really good practitioner, he does what we should do. Because intellectually, non-attachment, renunciation made a lot of sense to him. But yet, he noticed he wasn't inclined to it. So he did what we should do, like we should contemplate. Why isn't my heart leaping up at the idea, at the practice of renunciation, non-attachment? So we think about that. Like, I mean, we can intellectually imagine not being attached to our health. It doesn't mean we don't take care of our body, but inevitably, health comes and goes. Some of you have had dramatic reminders of that fact. Possessions come and go. We connected with an organization in North Minneapolis this morning, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. Maybe some of you have heard of them. But their building on Broadway was just burnt down right on the day they had organized a big rally in, is it March or April? Maybe it was middle of April. And that same day their building was burnt down, so we raised a little bit of money and contributed to them. But you know, there they were, they had planned this big march. I forget, there were several thousands of people at that march in middle of April, and just as they were sort of getting it underway right in that area, they could see the smoke from their building being burnt down. And it seems like it's I don't think the conclusions are totally in, but the police suspect arson and the building. So things, we know things can change. So why doesn't our heart, knowing that things change, knowing that fundamentally the world is ungovernable, you know, that insecurity isn't something that happens to us like a personal insult. It's just like built into the fabric of our existence. Things come and they go. Nobody, no one is in control, you know, it's just these innumerable causes and conditions. So intellectually, renunciation seems like a really good idea. But when it really comes down to it, you know, I go home, I notice like even with dessert with my wife, it's like, I want the bigger piece. I could renounce that, but I don't often. You know, and just competition or like in discussions, wanting to get my idea out. And, you know, we could just like, I wonder what it would be like just to let everybody else talk for a while. So it's interesting to see that even though it makes a lot of sense, how nice it would be to not be attached, like nature, the conditions as they are, they're going to unfold. How nice it would be not to be tight about how that unfolding is. But yet, what I find, and what we find generally, is that we do get tight about it. So the Buddha suggests we should contemplate it, and he says that that's what he did, he contemplated. And specifically, he contemplated the drawbacks of attachment, right? The drawbacks of attachment to our experiences, to the conditions, or in Buddhism, maybe you've heard this, the eight worldly winds. So the attachment to gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and disrepute, and praise and blame. So the Buddha talks about the vicissitudes of life, how just for everybody, I mean, it's not the same for everybody. Some people get more blame, some people get more fame, but generally everybody gets a little blame and fame, a little pain and pleasure, a little gain and loss, a little praise and blame, fame and disrepute. So these things, they just unfold. So we want to contemplate the weight, the dukkha, the suffering of attachment, of being tight, of thinking that my happiness, my well-being is a function of how things unfold. So then when things go badly, I lose my job, I get sick, somebody treats me in a disrespectful way or cuts me off on the freeway, then because that isn't what I wanted, doesn't fit my idea of what's pleasant, then I need to be the one who's suffering. But because my idea of happiness is having that, and so when I don't have it, I must be. And you know, our conditioned mind, more than anything, likes consistency. You know, that integrity. We live according to the ideas we have of happiness and unhappiness. It's like people who get real sick initially think it's really bad, and then at some point, you know, when they realize it may be around for a while, if they're fortunate, they may realize, well, maybe I don't have to be unhappy just because I have a lot of unpleasantness in the body and my body's really sick. Or people who get a divorce or a breakup and you thought your happiness was dependent on being with this person and now that person isn't in your life anymore, so you assume you're unhappy. And then if you're fortunate, it's like space opens up in the mind and you realize, well, I don't have to be unhappy just because I thought my happiness was dependent on this relationship. I can actually see whether happiness is available now. Was my happiness actually dependent on being healthy, being in relationship, or those of you who want to be out of relationship, you know, still being in the relationship, is my happiness restricted because of the conditions? So first the Buddha says, the thought occurred to me, what is the cause? What is the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace? Then the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sensual pleasures. I haven't pursued that theme. I haven't understood the reward of renunciation. I haven't pursued that theme. Haven't familiarized myself with it. That's why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. So then the other half is to start paying attention to the places, ordinary little places in our lives, where we experience non-attachment. And notice that kind of lightness. It's like we learn a lot of this in sitting practice, where we want the sit to be over, but it's not over. You know, so there's a certain formality, like don't leave in the middle of the sit, the etiquette. So we're sitting there, and even though we don't want the sit to be continuing, we want it to be over, that's an attachment. But we don't need to be confused by that. It's like, okay, it's unpleasant being here. Maybe there's pain in the body or restlessness in the mind. But just because it is the way that it is, do we have to allow that proliferation that concludes with, I'm unhappy? We can stay right in that experience of, well, it's like this now. This experience of the body and mind is being known. And this is where we see that divide, that choice, where in a sense, we can be the one who depends on this ending, because I'm ready to be done. Or we can become the one, the heart, the mind, that's not dependent on whether the sit continues or is done. That's the joy of renunciation. A heart, and not to think of it to the nth degree, but just even moving in that direction, a heart that's more and more willing to let nature be nature. Nature is just this natural, lawful unfolding of causes and conditions of our lives. That means both internally, in terms of the activity of our minds the movement of emotion and thought, and externally, all the circumstances around us. So in, from the Buddhist point of view, from right view, a view that's in line with the way things are, then all that is just the movement of nature, the activity of nature. Things unfold lawfully, according to innumerable causes and conditions. And there's a way of coming into alignment with that. It's a lot about trusting. You know, we will have those compulsions to react according to the pleasantness or unpleasantness of the moment. But just because those compulsions are allowed, have some momentum in the heart and mind, doesn't mean we have to do anything. That's what we learn when we're sitting. We're sitting there. We have all kinds of compulsions. To scratch the cheek because there's a tickle, or to think about this, get lost in thought, to move the body. Pema Chodron has a funny line, never underestimate the desire to bolt. But just because that can seem as big as the universe, that desire, the craving to get the heck out of there, we can't, there's this other possibility, which is to feel what that feels like to have that desire. There's always that possibility to know that desire is just what it is. Some of you know Sylvia Boorstein, a well-known Buddhist author and one of the teachers at Spirit Rock in this tradition, what we call the insight meditation or Vipassana tradition here in the West. As Tim said, coming out of the Theravada Buddhist tradition from places like Thailand and Burma, Sri Lanka. But in one of her books, she says something like, desire pulls so hard, it's surprising to find that it's empty. And this is a powerful insight. You know, it's liberating. When we feel a strong desire, whatever it might be, a real tug in the heart. This is why it's useful to play, and it's, I think that's a good word, with ordinary experience, like having a fly on your skin when you're sitting, or regardless of whether you're formally meditating. It'd be very easy in a kind way to sort of encourage that fly to go somewhere else. But we can just play with that experience, like that strong desire. You know, in the mind, the conditioned mind will taunt us. Maybe the fly has plague. I think I read somewhere, I think it's in California. Anybody see that article in Yosemite? They found some, I don't know if it was squirrels, but something up in Yosemite had plague. Yeah, maybe flies in Minneapolis too. Or whatever else. You know, where has that fly been? Makes you wonder. A lot of people walk their dogs along Lake Calhoun, you know, so. So these thoughts will taunt the mind. They'll just arise because that's a lawful occurrence in the mind, right? That tendency of the mind to proliferate, to worry, to frighten itself, it's just there already. It's too late to do anything about the conditioned habits of the mind because they're already conditioned in. It'd be nice to sort of, you know, find a way to uproot all of those not so useful tendencies, conditioned habits of the mind, but that takes some time. And we don't need to postpone freedom and happiness until the mind is somehow free of all those conditioned patterns. We just need to understand what those conditioned patterns are and what they're not. They're just a conditioned pattern being known. They're not self. We don't have to personalize it and then personally feel dependent on not having that fly on my skin. It's not okay. So it's like in the yogic tradition, they have a term, maybe you've heard this in a yoga class, tapas, that fiery quality, like when the conditioned habits of the mind are to get rid of something or to get something, but we're practicing not being confused by that strong craving to get rid of or to get something. And so in a sense, we're wearing it down because it's shouting loudly, do that, and now, don't wait. And wisdom and awareness has enough continuity so the mind isn't forgetting. However loud that is, it's just a feeling being known. It's just a thought being known. It's just that experience being known, here and now. It's not more, it's not less than that. And that's a liberating refuge, to be in the knowing. Oh, it's just this being known. And that's where we begin to discern that taste of freedom that the Buddha talks about in terms of this path, having one flavor, the flavor of freedom. It's that flavor, that freedom rather, of not having to be pushed around by desire. There's this other option. One path is forever being pushed around by the desires that arise in the mind because the mind personalizes the desire. And it's important to know, it's not that we don't want to think that desires are bad. In a way, in the most simple way, desires are just the same as life energy. There is no living being that doesn't have desire moving in the mind and the heart, right? The desire to eat, the desire to move. As a social being, we have desires to be in community of different kinds. We have a desire for safety, desire to care, I think, altruistic desires. So we have all kinds of desires. And then, of course, some of those desires are not very wholesome. So as a living being, we need to be intimate, sensitive to desires, but we want to see desires for what they are. It's just a movement in the mind and heart. That's what is actually a desire? We're so busy personalizing it and trying to fulfill it, we rarely see desire for what it is. One of the reasons that we use the forms that we use in Buddhist practice, like sitting still, going on a sesshin or a Buddhist retreat, going into the wilderness or quiet place for a while, simplifying our lives, is that it makes the activity of desire more apparent. You know, the relative simplicity, like if we restrict ourselves to 2 meals a day, for example, and no snacks in between. I know that doesn't work for everybody. But to do that from time to time, or like some of the nuns and monks do, just 1 meal a day, and that's it. And then there's so much opportunity to see desire arise, or to put aside the cell phone for a while, to disconnect from social media and social interactions, like to make the resolve of silence for half of a day or a whole day or a weekend or something like that. Then we feel that strong desire for social engagement, to know what's on the headlines of the New York Times or something like that. Has the stock market fallen more? And it can feel really strong. But because we know it's a training, we get to play with that strong desire. And because we're not immediately acting out the craving to get rid of something or to get something, we get to see it. We get to see what it is. Oh, it feels like this. How interesting. It looks like this. In the body, it's like this. And we discover what I've been talking about is this other path. If we're always pursuing what we our likes and dislikes, we never realize there's another way. The way of non-clinging, right? That's the simplest way the Buddha talked about the path. The liberation through non-clinging. Conditions, experiences keep coming and going, but we practice not clinging. But not clinging is not the same as passivity, you know, like, so people get confused, you know, because one of the important trainings is to sit still or to go on a retreat, to go into a simple environment for a period of time. Then they assume, okay, so that means like that's like sort of good practitioner, but to be a really good practitioner, you know, you'd have to go into one of those float tanks where you don't see anything. It's completely dark. There's no sounds. You're floating on salt water. Very few sensations. Like, if only I didn't exist, then I'd be enlightened. If that's what the Buddha taught, we probably wouldn't trust that kind of path. So non-attachment is not the same as non-engagement, which is why, like, when we talk about our refuge, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, we're talking about the Buddha, this awakened quality, waking up, being intimate with the way it is. That's what Dhamma or Dharma means. It means being intimate, feeling what we feel, seeing what we see, aware of the thoughts, aware of the sensations, being in this embodied state, right? As long as we're living, we are embodied creatures. There's this body, we're living this life through. So the non-attachment only makes sense when we're intimate. It's like relatively easy to conceive of non-attachment when we're in some blissed out state. Right? You don't care. When you're in a blissed out state of concentration, you don't care if there are flies walking on you, or if there's construction outside the Zen center, or you have a toothache, or somebody insulted you earlier in the day, because your mind is in some absorbed state, some peaceful state. But how about when that peaceful state eventually follows its course, right? It arises, it lasts for a while, and then for whatever reason, eventually, no matter how beautiful or profound the concentration state is, it will end. And are we going to be a living being craving my next sit when I can, get into that really quiet space? Or are we going to take up the path of wisdom? We're interested in a heart, a mind that's not dependent even on heavenly states, refined concentration states. You can see people who are really good meditators get really obsessive, about people moving in the meditation hall. There's stories of, teachers, when one of those noisy people leave the community, tracking them down and bringing them back, because understanding it's important to have some grist, right? Something to push our buttons. One of the great things about having a spiritual community is, and getting involved in that spiritual community is, you're going to realize it's not perfect. Because, initially it's like, oh, the Minnesota Zen Center, it's so peaceful, so perfect. And same with any spiritual organization. And then because it's so great, we commit. We become a student, we get volunteer, and then we realize it's not perfect. Like, there are actual human beings here with stuff, unfinished business. And then we realize that, the Buddhist path is not about transcending the messiness of the world. It's how to be right in the middle of an imperfect world with an imperfect body and an imperfect conditioned mind. How to be right in the middle of it, but not pushed around, not confused by it. How can we live in this space of our lives? And we want to keep seeing it like, I can struggle. I can believe in the path of struggling. Struggling to make myself different than who I am. Struggling to make you different than who you are so it's more pleasing to me. Right? This is our tact with our partners, our friends. If only she were this way, my life would be so much better. If only my body were this way, if only the politics in the United States were this way, if only the stock market were going the other way, if only. And we keep going that path and we keep experiencing the natural fruit of that point of view, which is stress and fear and more greed to make the world, to want the world to be other than the way it is. Or we can notice it feels like this now. This experience is being known. Well, can that be okay? Is there right now, we can check right now, is there right now a mind or heart, a way of being that can be radically okay with the way it is? Fearless, soft, receptive, alert, engaged. Is it dangerous for us right now to sink in, open up, little rootlets connecting, like I'm in this room with a bunch of people here on the shores of Lake Calhoun, this moment, this place, this body, this confusion, this... So we begin to intuit this other way of, it's a releasing into the moment, like a free fall, really. It's a kind of a good barometer, the sense of no ground. But it's not like we're trying to have no ground. It's more of a something opening up, something that is in the very nature of a mind that's not grasping for things to be other than the way they are. And this is what the Buddha is saying when he realized that his heart wasn't leaping up, as much as it made sense to not cling, he realized his heart wasn't leaping up at it. So he needed to, and so we might want to follow his way, because he seemed to know what he was talking about, to specifically, continuously contemplate the drawback of any time, in any moment we notice the mind clinging, attached, the promise that's never kept, right? If only, then I'll be happy. Not to judge ourselves for being attached, but to just, in a way, we're just collecting a data point. Oh, this is stressful. Needing this talk to be over so I can get home. That dependence right now in my mind is a little psychic weight. And that's the data point. We're not judging that fact. We're just acknowledging. Oh, okay, so it's like that. And then if we're having a moment of non-attachment, sort of a more timeless, open state of not clinging, non-attachment, not needing things to be other than the way they are, then we're noticing what that's like. Oh, non-attachment is like this, like that. I mentioned that free fall. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, tells a story, I don't know if he does anymore, but he used to way back when, about getting thrown out of an airplane and falling and realizing you don't have a parachute and freaking out, and then eventually realizing there's no ground. And that's like realizing the mind free of grasping, free of attachment, is realizing that. Because normally we think we need the attachment. It kind of solidifies, it sort of makes us feel safe. I know what I'm doing. If I'm going to get this. I'm going to stop at the co-op and get some good ice cream after this because, you know, I did what I had to do and now I get a reward. But those thoughts, any feelings, they just come and they go. So there's no ground. The mind's not establishing itself. It's not creating a dependency. So it's not about not having that thought about ice cream or about getting rid of something unpleasant. It's about not establishing herself anywhere in that. So I want to open it up for a little discussion, but I'll just share a poem. This is from, some of you know, David White, a contemporary poet, wonderful poet. And this poem is called Enough. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. until now. So it'd be nice, you know, whether you realize it or not, we've all been sort of playing at that crossroads between struggle, the struggle of attachment, and the radical acceptance and allowing and trusting that it's like this, it feels like this, it's just this feeling. So we've learned a lot. So any questions you have or comments from your practice you'd like to share with the group? And Wanda, you just let me know when we should end. So what comes to mind?
Mark, can you talk about what happens? What about when you really need to change what is? What is really needs fixing?
Yeah. In real time, it doesn't take long when we see something. I mean, nowadays, especially when the more we hear about racial injustice, the more difficult it becomes to be in denial or unaware of the different injustices in our larger communities. You know, we feel something. Right? We hear it, we see it, and then we feel something with that. And I notice in my own mind, my own heart, this like not wanting it to be true. So in the first moment, what we want is we want to make peace. We want to allow that feeling, whatever it is, to be felt, to be, we need to be intimate with that. So that our action, our movement into action, some response, isn't arising because of an unwillingness to feel what we're feeling. But it doesn't mean that we have to like feel it for weeks or years. It just means that part of the practice, like the part of the part of our response that Buddhist practice adds is to touch into what is happening internally in the heart and mind, and to realize how it really informs, creatively informs our response in the world. Because often what happens is we respond because I'm embarrassed being a white, straight male. So I'm going to, you know, I'm embarrassed, I feel guilty about that, so I'm going to make myself feel better by getting involved in some way. But you see how corrupt that ends up being, that attitude. So for me, initially, it's really important to notice that unpleasant feeling of confusion that I feel, like not knowing what to do. And the unpleasant feeling of realizing, like one image I've read recently, the sort of about privilege is having the wind at your back. Some of you have backpacked or taken walks, like around the lake, you know. So certain part of the lake, it's like, oh, what a nice day to be walking. Until you get to the part where the wind isn't at your back and is in your face. And then you realize how hard it is to walk. It's a little bit like, as we start to notice how privileged our lives are, some of us, and then sensing how challenging it is for other people. Even generationally, I think it's more difficult for young people than it was for me as a young adult in terms of making my way. So I think the first step is we need to be willing to feel what we feel. Practice not being confused by the feeling, and to really see that as part of that powerful action response to our life, to the moment as it is, and not to miss that piece, so that our response isn't coming from a fear of feeling what we feel, but is really coming from a willingness to feel what we feel. This is often the case in Buddhist practice. People equate the practice following the teachings of the Buddha with becoming more and more passive. The world is just the world. It has to figure its own, you know, its own self out. I'm just going to go my own way. But that's not my understanding. And certainly it's not what the Buddha acted out. I mean, there he was, you know, in the middle of a culture and trying to run an amorphous organization of many women and men from different castes, different sort of classes, and teaching things that sort of were against the grain. So he was right in the middle of the world. Messy politics, evil cousins who wanted to do him in, other religious sects that were in competition, felt in competition at least with the Buddha and his followers. So it was a messy scene. He didn't disappear into the woods. Other thoughts that come to mind? Yeah.
Thanks for your talk. A lot of it really resonated deeply with me. But I also found myself struggling with the word happiness, the way you used it, the first maybe half of your talk, where it's like there's this happiness of the path of following your desires and trying to grasp and cling on to things. And then there's the other happiness of non-attachment, of noticing that fundamental okayness about things without needing to follow the clinging. And I guess I'd just like to maybe suggest, or at least for myself, it was helpful to think of that non-attached happiness more as aliveness or intimacy, just to use a different word to express it. Felt like it made sense.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I think you'll find that they try to be careful with that more than I was tonight in the tradition, that often happiness is equated with the happiness of attachment. And then the deeper state, they use words more like release, unshakable release of the heart, or the sort of liberation of the heart. Yeah. The cessation of grasping, the cessation of the suffering of grasping. Yeah, thanks for that. Good point.
I think I'm going to have to apologize. They're
sure.
They've let out upstairs, so that's our cue that we've gone over.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to pass the Donna bowl around and make some announcements as that's going around.